The Miracle Patch. Perhaps Neville best described our power of belief to transcend the limits of our past. From his perspective, all that we experience, literally everything that happens to us or is done by us, is the product of our consciousness and absolutely nothing else. Until his death in 1972, he shared the keys of using imagination and belief to open the door of the miracles in our lives. From Neville's perspective, the miracle is the outcome itself. By its very nature, it describes a situation that has already happened. While miracles are often associated with the reversal of disease, and they are certainly welcome when they appear that way in our lives, miracles aren't limited to physical healings. The definition of a miracle is an event that appears inexplicable by the laws of nature. And this is where we find a miracle's power. It's beyond the logic of where it comes from or how it happened. The fact is that it did happen. And in the presence of the miracle, we are changed. Although different people may be changed in different ways, when we experience something that we cannot explain, it gives us pause. We must reconcile that miracle with what we believe to be true in the past. Sometimes a true life example is the best way to illustrate just such a point. The morning light peeked from behind the mountains, and suddenly the desert seemed alive. In the first rays of the early sun, I could see the faces of the young Egyptian soldiers, our military escort, staring back into our tour bus from the lead truck in our convoy. With five or so men seated on makeshift benches lining either side of the truck bed, their job was to escort us safely across the Sinai Desert and into the huge city of Cairo, Egypt. During our time in the mountains, the political situation in Egypt had become tense. Now, for our overland route back to the hotel, a checkpoint system had been set up for our own safety and to establish where we were at all times. I knew that it would be only a matter of minutes before we would slow to a stop, a guard would step onto the bus to check our papers, say shokran, which means thank you in Egyptian, and we'd be on our way. After clearing the first series of checkpoints, we soon found ourselves winding our way along the brilliant white beaches of the Red Sea toward the Suez Canal. In the warmth of the late morning sun pouring through our sightseeing coach, I closed my eyes and I imagined the same scene over 3,000 years ago as the people of Egypt traveled a similar route to the mountain from which we were now returning. Except for the buses and the paved roads, I wondered how much had really changed. Well, suddenly everything stopped. I looked up as our bus came to a halt along a busy boulevard. From my seat just behind the bus driver, I peered through the windows looking for familiar landmarks to orient myself. To my amazement, we were stopped in front of a monument. It is one of the most powerful symbols in all of Egypt, perhaps even more powerful than the pyramids themselves. It's the tomb of former President Anwar Sadat. As I stood up to speak with our guide and find out why we were stopped, I could see the activity in the street outside of our bus. The soldiers had jumped out from under the canopies of their troop carriers, and they were milling around with their superiors and our driver. As I hopped down from the stairwell of the bus onto the street, immediately, I noticed that it was not business as usual. The soldiers, our driver, our Egyptian guide, everyone had puzzled expressions on their faces. Some were tapping their wristwatches and holding them to their ears to see if they were still running. Others were anxiously shouting to one another in short bursts of Egyptian. "What's happening?" I asked our guide. "Why have we stopped here? This isn't our hotel." He looked at me in absolute awe. "Something is not right," he said with a rare intensity to his normally playful voice. "We should not be here yet." "What are you saying?" I asked. "This is precisely where we should be, on our way to our hotel in Giza." "No," he said, "you don't understand. We cannot be here yet. It hasn't been long enough since our departure from St. Catherine's Village in Sinai for us to be in Cairo. It takes at least 8 hours for us to make the drive under the Suez Canal, across the desert, and into the mountains. At least 8 hours. With the checkpoints, we should be even later. Look at the guards. Even they don't believe their eyes. It's been only 4 hours. Our being here is a miracle." As I watched the men in front of me, an eerie feeling swept over my body. Although I'd had experiences similar to this one when I was alone, it had never happened with an entire group. Following a troop carrier and observing the speed limits, and with the extra time at the checkpoints, how could our driving time have been cut in half? Though the distance between Cairo and St. Catherine's Village hadn't changed, our experience of time while we traveled the distance did change. It was a fact that was recorded on the wristwatches of every military man, every armed guard, and every passenger in our bus. It was as if our memories of the day had somehow been squeezed into an experience of half the time we expected. Where was the rest of our time? What happened and why? The conversations that were happening on the bus during the drive may offer a clue. Our group was scheduled for a private entrance into the Great Pyramid later in the evening. For many people, it would be the highlight of the entire trip, and it had been the topic of conversation since we began our morning. In the innocence of anticipating the experiences that were yet to come, the group was talking about their experience as if it had already happened, as if they were already inside of the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. They were talking about what sounds they would utter in the acoustically perfect room, how the air would smell, and what it would feel like to be inside of the monument that they'd seen in movies and museum documentaries since they were children. Well, the key to our mystery is this. In their beliefs, they were already inside of the Great Pyramid. Just as Neville describes in his writings, they were assuming the feeling of their wish fulfilled. In doing so, they shifted their focus from how long the bus trip would take to what it was like to be in the pyramid. On that day, with 60 or so people all sharing a common feeling, their reality changed to reflect their feeling. Interestingly, even those who were not actively participating in the experience, the soldiers, the drivers, and the guides, shared the benefit of what was created. Well, there's no scientific reason to explain why travelers on a journey that would normally take a full day could cover the same distance in half the time. And that is the definition of a miracle. It's an event that cannot be explained by the laws of science, at least as we know those laws today. Well, I'm sharing this story for two reasons. First, I want to illustrate that a miracle can be experienced alone or with a group. Either way, everyone can participate in the same group dream and experience the same outcome. Second, this story demonstrated that the group miracle could happen spontaneously. Just as we've seen, there was no conscious effort by the people on the bus to make us go faster or to get to Cairo quicker. On the contrary, in the minds of those excited about the evening to come, they were already there. As they accepted their experience as if it were already happening, their reality of time shifted to accommodate their experience. The beauty of this miracle is that no one had to understand the physics of time warps, wormholes, and quantum energy for it to happen. And I believe that reality works just this way. I also believe that it can change just this easily. In terms of our miracle patch, what's important here is that our group experience wasn't the result of a mental process of logic. We didn't go through all the reasons that may have led to a long trip or try to convince our driver to take a shortcut. We didn't have to understand why it worked for it to do so. In fact, this story beautifully illustrates that it's less about making something happen and more about believing that it already has. Riding on our bus that day, we simply abandoned ourselves to the feeling and belief that we were already in the place we'd waited a lifetime and traveled half a world to see. Maybe that's all it takes to wrinkle space and time and to breathe life into our dreams on a regular basis. This is why the miracle patch can be so powerful. There does, however, appear to be one caveat to our experience of a miracle, and it's summarized in belief code number 31. It states that while we don't have to understand why it works, we must be willing to accept what the miracle brings into our lives. Sometimes, just when we need the power of a miracle, they come from the places that we'd least expect. They can come to us as a drastic alteration in our physical reality or as a simple synchronicity in our lives. Sometimes they're big and can't be missed, like the vision of Our Lady of the Rosary that appeared to 50,000 people on a hillside near Fatima, Portugal in 1917, for example. Other times they're so subtle that if we aren't aware, we may miss them altogether. They can come from the words of a stranger that we suddenly and mysteriously encounter at just the right moment. If we listen carefully, we'll always hear the right words at just the right time to dazzle us into a realization of something that we may have missed only moments before. Believing our way to a greater possibility. The last chapters have shown that when we ask ourselves to transcend our limitations, what we're really asking is to change our beliefs, and to do so we need a good reason. Well, the corollary to this principle is that when the paradigm of an old belief is shattered, to have a widespread effect, it must be done in the presence of others. In all probability, some runner somewhere in the world could have run the 4-minute mile a month before Roger Bannister ever did. And if he or she did so in the privacy of his or her own backyard track, where the only one watching was the family pet, how could it be accepted by others? Like the tree that falls in the forest with no one to hear, who would ever know? Clearly, our personal triumphs must be experienced by others to anchor them as a possibility in those people's lives. Each time we experience a miracle, we upgrade their programs of belief and send consciousness a new blueprint for reality. We've seen this principle work many times. From Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad, to Gandhi, Mother Teresa, and Martin Luther King, each person lived a new way of being in the presence of others. They did so within the very consciousness that they chose to change. We may have heard about such powerful examples of change for so long that we take them for granted today. But a closer look at the way these masters have seeded new ideas in an existing paradigm is nothing short of astonishing. What makes their accomplishments so powerful is the way they made their changes. It's easy for a computer programmer, for example, to sit in an office somewhere with a bird's-eye view of a virtual program and see where changes need to be made. Once they're identified, the programmer can isolate portions of the program, modify them, or rewrite them altogether time and time again until the output is just right. The key here is that the programmer is outside of the program, looking in from a perspective where it's easy to see what's needed. So, in a sense, programmers are like Monday morning quarterbacks looking back on a game that's already been played, where it's easy in hindsight to see what should have happened. They're watching the game from the sidelines, and here's the reason that this makes what you and I do so much more powerful. In our quantum consciousness computer, we're not on the sidelines. We're in the same program that we're trying to change. We are searching for meaning, healing, and peace and abundance within the same program where we've experienced hate, suffering, and war. In computer science lingo, when a program has the intelligence to evaluate a situation and respond in a new way, it is said to have intelligence. And because the intelligence comes from a machine, it's said to be artificial. A recent example of artificial intelligence that made worldwide headlines is the program named Deep Blue. Designed specifically as a chess-playing program, on February 10, 1996, the Deep Blue program won Game 1 against the reigning world chess champion in a match that was seen around the world. After the game, the champion commented that the computer program showed what he called deep intelligence and creativity, and that even the chess master could not understand. In some respects, we may not be so very different from Deep Blue. Within the consciousness computer of the universe, we are evaluating the conditions that life throws our way. We're making the best choices possible using the information that we have. The key here is that we tend to make those choices based upon what we believe about our capabilities and our limits within the universe. As we recognize that everyday reality is the palette that displays our possibilities rather than the reflection of our limits, what we may have considered as impossible in the past now is within our grasp. Suddenly, everything that we could ever imagine, and probably things that we've never even considered, become possible within this way of thinking. As we learn to hone the quality of our beliefs in very precise ways, we're learning to change the belief waves of disease into healing, the patterns of war into peace, and failure and lack into success and abundance in our world. What could be more powerful? What could be more sacred? Is it any wonder that everything from religions to entire nations have been built around the power of our beliefs?